From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the latest on the missing Malaysian passenger jet, Ukraine's NEM leader at the White House, possible truth commission for Mali, plus the Pistorius trial in South Africa. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Associated Press is reporting that a senior Chinese aviation official says it cannot be confirmed that objects floating in the sea captured on Chinese satellite images are linked to a Malaysia Airlines jet that's been missing since Saturday. Li Jiangshang, chief of the Civil Aviation Administration of China, told reporters Thursday that the authorities could not confirm that the three objects of varying sizes detected by Chinese satellites belong to that missing aircraft. They were spotted in the sea off the southern tip of Vietnam and east of Malaysia on Sunday morning. The plane carrying 239 people went missing Saturday morning while flying from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing. Well, for some analysis of the Chinese satellite images, NBC's Ann Curry spoke with a former U.S. Senior Air Safety Director for the National Transportation Safety Board. Greg Fife was asked whether he believes those images are of the Malaysian plane.
Based on the resolution of these images, I'm skeptical at this point. Normally, if you have pieces of aircraft or possibly pieces of aircraft this large, you would expect to see a large debris field because this is a very large piece of or pieces of aircraft. So you would expect to see not only the 70-foot by 72-foot piece of structure, if this is airplane, but all the debris that would go with it, seat cushions, seats. The water isn't that deep there.
What you're saying is you're not banking on it. So if, in fact, this isn't the wreckage and the plane did, in fact, make a turn, as we heard earlier today, could we, in fact, be looking possibly at a criminal investigation here?
I think that still has to be considered, given the fact that we've had varying information over the last 5 days. Nothing has been confirmed, and the stuff that we thought was confirmed, some of the information, has been basically retracted. So I think we have to, or at least investigators would have to, continue to pursue the intentional act or criminal aspect of it, as well as this possibly being an accident.
So you're saying that you would endorse that the search continues not along the flight path as we saw these images, according to the China news agency, that that's where they took those photographs. But you're saying that we should still be looking in the Indian Ocean?
We need to vet. We need to validate what that object is that is on that satellite image. Somebody needs to actually look and identify that as aircraft part or parts. But you can't give up where that radar image was coming from because there are a number of radar points. They were very, very firm in saying, we had this airplane tracked, so you must continue along that path as well and possibly even further.
Greg Fife is a former senior air safety director for the U.S. National Transportation Safety Board and a veteran pilot. He appeared on the NBC Nightly News with Ann Curry. You can keep up to date on the search for that missing Malaysian passenger plane at our website, voanews.com. At the White House on Wednesday, President Obama again warned Russia about interfering in Ukraine.
We will continue to say to the Russian government that if it continues on the path that it is on, then not only us, but the international community, the European Union and others will be forced to apply a cost to Russia's violations of international law and its encroachments on Ukraine. There's another path available, and we hope that President Putin is willing to seize that path. If he does not, I'm very confident that the international community will stand strongly behind the Ukrainian government in preserving its unity and its territorial integrity.
Mr. Obama was speaking alongside interim Ukrainian Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk.
Mr. President, it's all about the freedom. We fight for our freedom, we fight for our independence, we fight for our sovereignty, and we will never surrender.
President Obama also took the opportunity of Wednesday's meeting with Mr. Yatsenyuk to reiterate the U.S. opposition to the planned Sunday referendum in which the people of Crimea will get the chance to decide if they want to break away from Ukraine and become part of Russia.
We completely reject a referendum patched together in a few weeks with Russian military personnel basically taking over Crimea. We reject its legitimacy. It is contrary to international law. It is contrary to the Ukrainian Constitution.
Earlier on Wednesday, leaders of the group of seven leading industrialized nations said they also do not recognize that Crimean referendum. The G7, which includes Britain, Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, and the U.S., also called on Russia to, in their words, cease all efforts to change the status of Crimea contrary to Ukrainian law. Well, why Prime Minister Yatsenyuk was here in Washington on Wednesday, hundreds of pro-Ukraine activists gathered in the center of the city of Luhansk to show their support for the new Ukrainian government. Luhansk, with other eastern Ukrainian towns, have a higher rate of pro-Russian activists than any other region in Ukraine. Some of the demonstrators held signs that read, "Save us from our rescuers," referring to recent comments from Moscow that Russia had to rescue pro-Russian activists in the region.
Я за мир, я против війни в нашій країні, я против сепаратистів. Я вважаю, що Луганськ – Україна, я Україна.
Олена Федорова was one of those demonstrators. She said, "I am for peace and against the war in our country, against separatists. Luhansk is Ukraine. I'm Ukrainian and don't want to live in any other country." The United States is sending Secretary of State John Kerry to London later this week for a meeting with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, part of an effort to end the crisis in Ukraine. VOA's Jeff Selden reports.
America's top diplomat says the face-to-face meeting will take place Friday and is just the latest in a series of conversations he and President Barack Obama have had with Russian officials.
While we respect, obviously, that Russia has deep historical, cultural, other kinds of interests with respect to Ukraine and particularly Crimea, nothing justifies a military intervention that the world has witnessed.
Secretary of State John Kerry told lawmakers the U.S. and its European partners have made clear to Moscow there are many ways to address its concerns without further escalation. And he said the U.S. does not believe it would serve anyone's interests to isolate Russia. Still, he issued this warning.
We will do what we have to do if Russia cannot find the way to make the right choices here.
Jeff Selden, VOA News, Washington.
And as with much of the world's news, you can keep up to date with events in Ukraine plus international efforts to ease the tensions there at our website, voanews.com.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. You can listen to Encounter on Saturdays and Sundays. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on the Voice of America.
United Nations is calling for independent investigations into drone attacks after an apparent threefold increase in civilian deaths from drones last year. But the remoteness of the strike locations and what critics describe as government secrecy often hampers efforts to assess the impact on civilians. Henry Ridgewell reports that researchers are using innovative techniques to aid investigations.
Ich, mein Sohn und Tamara, dann ist es auch schon passiert.
In a studio in Düsseldorf, Germany, the survivor of a drone attack relays her memories of the incident to a team of researchers. The woman, a German national, was in her house in the North Waziristan region of Pakistan when it was struck by a drone missile in October of 2010. The researchers are forensic architects from Goldsmiths University of London and Situ Research in New York. They used the testimony to construct a 3D model of the attack. Techniques like this answer a vital question in the debate over drones, says Susan Shupley, senior research fellow of the project at Goldsmiths.
What does drone warfare actually produce as a kind of lived reality on the ground?
Shupley and her team use before and after satellite images, cross-referenced with eyewitness testimony, local maps and other data in their reconstructions. The aim is to aid investigations into drone strikes that have taken place in Pakistan, Afghanistan, Yemen, Gaza and Somalia.
It counters a certain perception that there's very little that we can know about these strikes that often take place in what are considered to be remote regions of the world. And consequently, there seems to be less of a kind of imperative on the part of the countries most implicated in these strikes to investigating an event that is so kind of far outside of the kind of almost the collective imagination.
The work is contributing to a United Nations report on the legality of drone operations. Ben Emerson, a UN special investigator on protecting human rights while countering terrorism, said Tuesday there had been a threefold increase in civilian casualties from drones in 2013.
In each of the cases, the evidence is sufficient to cross the threshold identified in my interim report as imposing a legal duty on the relevant states to provide a public explanation of the circumstances and the justification for the use of deadly force.
So far, the United States and other countries that operate armed drones have offered little explanation, says Kat Craig, legal director at the legal action charity Reprieve.
The entire drone program is shrouded in secrecy. There is no clarity or transparency about the targeting process, about the decisions that are made. There's no transparency when mistakes are made and no accountability to that effect.
Drones are the least bad option in a necessary fight, says Douglas Murray, associate director of London-based policy analyst group, the Henry Jackson Foundation.
If you're objecting to drone strikes, then you have to my mind, explain how else you deal with this problem of radicals and terrorists existing in these areas. Either you send in large numbers of forces, or you do drone strikes, or you've got to do something else. What is the something else?
The United Nations says US drone attacks in Pakistan appear to have decreased rapidly, with none at all reported so far in 2014. But the UN says drone strikes have increased in Yemen, and so has the number of civilian casualties. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Mali's National Assembly expected to discuss the creation of a Truth, Justice and Reconciliation Commission this week. Human rights groups have expressed concern that the proposed commission will not have the necessary independence to make a difference. VOA's Anne Look has more from our West Africa Bureau.
The new Mali is a work in progress. The crisis of 2012 and 2013 divided the country like never before, both literally and figuratively. A French-led military intervention may have physically reunited much of the country early last year, but communal divisions are far from healed. President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita says national reconciliation is a top priority. But first, Malians must figure out what exactly happened and why. This week, the National Assembly will debate the legal framework to create a commission to do just that. The proposed commission would have 3 years to explore crimes committed during this most recent crisis and during previous conflicts in the north. It would go back as far as independence in 1960. A previous commission created last year by the former interim government accomplished little. Its failings left Malians doubting the very idea. Human rights groups say this time the commission must be seen as impartial and representative. Attorney Mokhtar Mariko is head of the Malian Association for Human Rights. He says the mandate of the commission needs to be clearly spelled out, and the men and women who lead it cannot have been implicated in the crimes that were committed throughout the country. He says this commission must be truly independent. There is talk of attaching the commission to the relatively new Ministry of Reconciliation and Development for the North. Mariko says that's a bad idea, as it would open the commission up to political interference. The proposed commission would have 15 members and 7 working groups. International rights group Human Rights Watch says Malians should get a say in those appointed. The group says there should be a wide consultation with civil society, political parties, and other groups, along with public confirmation hearings. Human Rights Watch is also calling for the commission to have investigative powers that would allow it to refer cases to the criminal justice system and recommend reparations for victims. The proposed commission would be called the Truth, Justice and Reconciliation Commission. Many Malians say that is exactly the order in which things must happen for this initiative to succeed. Truth, justice, then reconciliation. Anne Luck, VOA News, Dakar.
East African leaders will be meeting in Ethiopia today to discuss the mandate and size of a stabilization and protection force to be deployed in South Sudan. Marta van der Wolf has more now from Addis Ababa.
Heads of state of the East African bloc IGAD, which has been mediating talks between South Sudan's warring sides, are now turning attention to troop deployment. Ethiopian Foreign Ministry spokesperson Dina Mufti says the extraordinary summit is devoted just to South Sudan.
They'll be talking about the deployment of forces to the region, which most of them have agreed, because there is going to be a deployment of the African brigades from all IGAD countries plus two other non-IGAD members, Burundi and Rwanda.
Other countries that have said they are ready to send troops to South Sudan are Ethiopia, Kenya and Djibouti. The presence of Ugandan troops in the country from the beginning of the conflict has led to criticism by the opposition side and the international community that they are an obstacle to a peaceful solution. So Uganda's troop will slowly be withdrawn. Fighting broke out in South Sudan mid-December after a dispute within the ruling SPLM. The dispute led to fighting between forces of President Salva Kiir and soldiers loyal to former Vice President Riek Machar. A January ceasefire hasn't taken hold, so regional leaders are determining how best to reinforce the truce. Dina Mufti says they're looking at how many troops will be needed and the extent of their mandate.
This is a kind of peacekeeping force, so they are going to reinforce or realize the cessation of hostility. They will help in that process. They will help the monitors and the people who verify the cessation of hostilities or the ceasefire.
After IGAD heads of state decide on the mandate and the size of the force, the African Union and the United Nations will need to give approval before the force can actually be deployed. The conflict in South Sudan has killed thousands of people and displaced close to a million. To ensure the participation of the South Sudanese people in the peace process, a civil society conference will be held in Addis Ababa after the IGAD summit. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
A South African police forensics analyst says Oscar Pistorius was probably not wearing his prosthetic legs when he used a cricket bat to hit the door through which he fatally shot his girlfriend, an assertion that counters claims made by the athlete. In a court testimony on Wednesday, Johannes Vermeulen said he believes Pistorius was on his stumps when he used the bat to try to break down the door last year after fatally shooting Reva Steenkamp. The door was set up in the courtroom as Vermeulen described how marks on the bat matched one smaller and one larger hole in the door.
The marks on the door is actually consistent with him not having his legs on, and I suspect it must be similar to the height that he was when he fired the shots.
Pistorius said in an affidavit during a bail hearing last year that he had put on the prosthetics prior to hitting the door with a cricket bat. While cross-examining Vermeulen, defense lawyer Barry Rue said his team would show that Pistorius was in a standing position when he caused a mark on the door.
We will present evidence that that mark was caused by the prosthesis kicking that door or making contact with that door. And the fabric of the sock was in fact still embedded and found and varnish of the door on the prosthesis.
Rue also tried to cast doubt on the initial police investigation, saying there was evidence that a footprint on the door was made by a police officer's shoe. Prosecutors accused Pistorius of murdering Steenkamp after an argument, while Pistorius says he thought he was shooting at an intruder.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
One of the most recognized toy names in the world, known by children and adults alike, is Lego. It has long been a very popular thing, these bricks, and even video games, and now a full-length feature film. Lego building blocks may be more than 50 years old, but fans continue to grow across all ages. Elizabeth Lee reporting now from Los Angeles on this Lego phenomenon.
While many adults miss the sense of wonder they felt as children about what their imaginations could create, some grown-ups can still capture that feeling through tiny bricks.
That sound to me is the sound of creativity.
That's Peter Abrahamson's favorite sound. He has been playing with Lego bricks for more than 40 years.
The amazing thing I always found about Lego was the ability of a toy to make other toys.
Abrahamson builds Lego creations at home with his daughter and connects with other fans at the Lego Users Group of Los Angeles. There are adult fan clubs like this around the world where creations are displayed and fans buy, sell, and trade Lego pieces. Available in 53 different colors, the Lego bricks sold in 1 year would circle the globe 5 times.
This is my first mosaics ever made.
Marianne Asanuma makes a living selling Lego creations. She says when she was a child, more boys played with Lego bricks than girls, and that's still mostly true.
If you go to like a convention or something, there's about 5% women to 95% men.
Adult men who are willing to spend money on Lego sets for themselves, says Paul Hollingsworth, whose zombie prison displayed at the fan meeting is worth around $600.
It's like if I look around at some of these models, like I'm seeing hundreds of dollars spent. And I know my wife would much rather have a purse or a handbag or a pair of shoes or a dress, whereas guys would rather have 50 zombies or a giant spaceship.
But as Lego toys continue to be popular, they are now being marketed to girls as well as boys.
Playing Lego is something that I could do with my daughter, who's like 7 years old.
Hello, I'm Haley, and I love Lego bricks.
Hollingsworth's daughter, Haley, even has a YouTube show showing her audience how to build Lego creations.
Yes!
Nathan Sawaya also has a global audience, but instead of the virtual world, he shows his Lego creations in contemporary art galleries and exhibitions.
We've been to Singapore, Taiwan, Shanghai, South Africa.
His artwork attracts people of all ages.
Art made out of Lego bricks is very accessible, right? People have Lego bricks at home, so they can connect to the art in a different way.
While some people connect with Lego creations at an art exhibit, others experience the Lego world through Legoland amusement parks or at the theater, with the Lego movie released worldwide.
Batman, formidable!
We love the movie. I've seen it twice.
Lego fan Paul Lee says Lego bricks are timeless for a reason.
The Lego brick they sell today is still compatible with the brick they made 30 years ago.
Many of these fans say they will pass on their Lego bricks to their children and hope their grandchildren will still be playing with them as the family Lego collection continues to grow with each generation. Elizabeth Lee for VOA News, Los Angeles.
And there's some good news at the London Zoo. It turns out that a 5-year-old Sumatran tiger, Malati, has given birth to triplets a little more than a year after the endangered tiger lost a 3-week-old cub. The zoo says the 3 cubs, whose sexes are not yet quite known, have arrived within an hour of one another. It happened back on February the 3rd. They've captured all the beginning moments on hidden cameras, and they're monitoring the little cubs around the clock. I'm sure they're cute as they can be. Hey, listen, everyone. Thanks for tuning in to the Voice of America for International Edition. A reminder, you can always find us on the internet at voanews.com. Hope you'll stay with us. The latest world news is coming up shortly. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jimmy Cook, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Thursday.
This is Today in History. On March 13, 1733, British clergyman Joseph Priestley was born. Although lacking a formal scientific education, Priestley contributed to the advancement of science by proving that electricity could be conducted through graphite, discovering soda water, and isolating a number of common gases, including carbon dioxide, nitrous oxide, and oxygen. On this day in 1781, German-born British astronomer Sir William Herschel discovered Uranus, the seventh planet from the sun. In 1881, reformist Tsar Alexander II of Russia was mortally wounded by a bomb thrown by a member of a radical group known as People's Will. In 1906, American women's rights activist Susan B. Anthony died. She played a key role in securing passage of the 19th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, granting women the right to vote. In 1921, Mongolia was proclaimed an independent monarchy, but was placed under the leadership of a Russian dictator. In 1943, the Nazi commander of police in the Polish city of Krakow ordered the elimination of the remaining Jewish population there. An estimated 10,000 people were either executed or transported to a forced labor camp. In 1954, the Battle of Dien Bien Phu began when communist Viet Minh forces besieged a French base in northwest Vietnam. The French eventually surrendered, losing their colonial possessions in Indochina. In 1969, the U.S. manned Apollo 9 mission ended successfully with a 10-day Earth orbital flight that proved that the space agency's Saturn V rocket, command vehicle, and lunar lander together could get men to the moon and safely back home. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States recently hosted the fourth round of the high-level partnership dialogue between the United States and Colombia. Secretary of State John Kerry opened the event noting, "The United States' relationship with Colombia is no longer defined solely by confronting criminality and subversion, but by working on the lasting prosperity that we are working to provide for people." For example, the United States and Colombia have projects to protect the environment, expand educational opportunities, promote human rights, and strengthen our energy networks. Also, the U.S.-Colombia Free Trade Promotion Agreement has brought immediate economic benefits to both nations. During the first year of the agreement, Colombia diversified its export base with more than 1,300 companies exporting goods to the United States for the first time. At the high-level partnership dialogue, delegations from both countries looked ahead at how we can work together even more effectively. "Underlying all of our cooperation," said Secretary Kerry, "is our shared commitment to protecting fundamental human rights. In support of this commitment, the U.S. Agency for International Development announced two new programs totaling $22 million to support local Colombian organizations to increase civil society participation in implementation of the Victims Law, prevent and respond to human rights violations, and improve access to justice." The U.S. delegation also urged Colombia to combat impunity, protect vulnerable individuals, and ensure the peace process does not result in amnesty for serious human rights violators on either side of the conflict. During the dialogue, Colombia and the United States reaffirmed their commitment to fight trafficking in persons by increasing cooperation on law enforcement efforts and reinforcing regional partnerships. Additionally, a new U.S.-Colombian Sister Parks program will bolster the planning, development, and operation of national parks in Colombia. The two countries also committed to expanding opportunities for Colombians to study in the U.S. and for more American students to study in Colombia, in keeping with President Barack Obama's 100,000 Strong in the Americas initiative to promote educational exchanges with all of Latin America, the Caribbean, and Canada. "There's no question in my mind," said Secretary Kerry, "that the relationship between the United States and Colombia has special value, special importance, has a special place in this hemisphere, and we really look forward to developing further this partnership and this friendship."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.